You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So the first piece, as was mentioned earlier, is the return of the interviews with Owen Gill. Owen Gill is the author of Turning Point Auckland, which is a book about the future of Auckland and how we can progress into the future as a city, as population grows, as our needs grow and change. So this is actually the third episode, but only the second to air. The second one is about the role of council and will be available online as well. I'll try and podcast that tonight or today, so you can listen to it on the drive home. If you're a podcast kind of person, you can find those on, I think, 95BFM/Bcast.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And so this one's about financing, as I mentioned before, and how we can actually continue to build our city without running out of money. And so, yeah, here he is.
There seems to be an issue that perhaps holds back cities, people, and ideas across the board, sadly. However, you list a few options that Auckland as a city has to raise capital to essentially save itself or improve itself, hence how skeptical slash critical you are. Yeah. I would summarize these as, and correct me if I view these wrong or differently, privatization and or sale of public slash commercial assets, searching for private sponsors or backers, and value capture, or what some could label as a gentrification tax. Could I get you to detail these more for the listeners?
Sure, absolutely. So let's start with the first one, which you mentioned. You call it privatisation. Auckland Council owns about $3 billion worth of assets, which it's inherited from the legacy councils. The biggest single asset is the 24% of Auckland Airport that they own, probably worth about $1.5 billion. They own some car parking buildings, some marinas, and some very big golf courses. And I argue in the book that Auckland Council ought to consider selling them. I don't say it should sell them, but I say it should look at it. But shift the proceeds from that, from the sale of those assets, if you did sell them, to assets that you need more. So the difficulty with car parking, buildings, marinas, golf courses, what have you, is they're either commercial businesses or now used by a very small part of the population, where you've got other things that you need much more. So let's take an example. I've got it in the book. Let's say you sold some of those assets and then built the third harbour crossing, which would have to be a tunnel by definition. So you then open up the shore and you'd be able to get rail onto the shore as well. So you're not selling or privatising assets, what you're trying to do is get capital out of some existing ones and into new ones. So that's the first thing. Your second one was value capture. Value capture is very popular among some people. So the way value capture works is I come along and build a big asset, say a railway line or a bridge or a tunnel, and then the values of properties around that go up disproportionately. There's a study into West Auckland after the double tracking of the railway line, the one that goes out to Newland and Henderson, which occurred in the lead up to the Rugby World Cup. Property values around that railway track grew disproportionately to the rest of Auckland because it was suddenly a much better place to live because of the public transport. So value capture says we'll take a part of that disproportionate property value. The big one that would be the City Rail Link, which is going to make the values of some central city properties a lot bigger.
Yeah, because that was seen, quite a bit in England and London, and specifically, I believe, in the way that they've extended their rail network.
That's Crossrail in London?
Yeah,
Crossrail is one-third funded by these types of charges.
Which is a pretty impressive way of collecting capital, I think.
Yes.
It does seem quite topical, though, due to, dare I say, its kind of immense similarity to almost a capital gains tax in a way.
I suppose it is a type of capital gains tax because you're taking a share of the capital gain as it occurs. There are some similarities, yeah, because you're effectively trying to capture some of the value of property or land, whichever way you want to argue about it, and shifting it back to the government. Except in this case, unlike the CGT that Dr. Cullen is proposing, the increase in value has been caused by the city investing, right? So you're effectively trying to get back a part of the public purse's own investment, whereas the capital gains tax that Dr. Cullen is proposing is across the board. I just want to, did you want me to quickly address private capital?
Most definitely, yeah.
So private capital is quite commonly used in Australia. The Australians are big users of private capital, and the British as well. So there are quite substantial global investment funds that look for what they call investable public projects, railways, tunnels, airports at times. So if you've been through any of the big tunnels in Sydney, Clem 7, there's the big tunnel in Brisbane, all built with private capital. The drawback of them, and sometimes this is why they're not popular, is the funds that back them typically want part of the revenue, so they you charge on them, right?
Yeah. Although you've explained the differences between essentially replacing what the council currently has funds in for stuff that they need more pressingly by selling them perhaps to private entities, do you think that there are, not necessarily just relating to what you've said, but in just in general, do you think there are any negatives of privatizing public stock? Similar things happened, I believe, throughout the 80s and early 90s, and a lot of people seem to recognize these actions as a mistake in retrospect. A, do you see any negatives of privatizing public stock? And if we were to do something along those lines, which other people do propose in order to move Auckland forward, what do you think would differentiate it to a new era of privatisation from what some people would say happened during the boom of neoliberalism?
There's some differences, and I think a lot of people in New Zealand learned some hard lessons at the end of the 80s. So you're right, in the period after about 1985, New Zealand privatised onsold its forestry assets, some banking assets, what became telecom, the remains of the post office, some broadcasting rights. I think the thing that happened, which lots of people found quite surprising, was that the capital disappeared into a down-paying debt, which is what Roger Douglas wanted to do. New Zealand was quite an indebted country. So no one saw anything new as a result of selling the forests and things. It just went into repaying enormous debts that we had to American and Japanese financiers. So a big lesson there. And also, of course, what happened is that typically when the assets were sold, and you know this was the case, for example, with the forestry assets and things like that, jobs disappeared as well, and services disappeared, particularly in small towns. Yeah, that was the experience of the banks, for example, when we sold them. So there's two things you want to do. The first thing you want to do is make sure that when you sell it, the capital goes into a fund and then you reinvest it in new things, which is not what happened in the 80s. So you could do, for example, in New Zealand, you know, you could set up in Auckland, for example, a Guardians of Capital, which might be three or four notable Aucklanders. Their job is to take the capital once it's released from your sale. They look after it and they only release it back to you, Auckland Council, when you come to them with a new asset and an investable thing. So you don't just sink it back into debt or operations. That's one thing. The second thing too, which again was a discovery that was made, you know, pretty brutally in New Zealand in the 80s and 90s, is that we sold things and then the new owners cranked up the prices or made the most of their monopoly, right, or what have you. That was one of the lessons of telecom, where we sold it and then it turned out to dominate the telecommunications market, and that continued until the Honourable David Cunliffe split telecom up by statute in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So you want to regulate. You don't want to sell car parks and things like that to a firm that then just sucks up the price.
One point in the book, you mentioned tax policy, yes, and an effective tax rate on investments in second and third homes. What do you believe is an effective tax rate, either on second or third homes or just in general? And do you think that people should be allowed to make investments in second and third homes?
You can't prevent people from making investments in second and third homes, fourth and fifth homes if you want. So you can't say to people, look, you can't build yourself a small private property empire. They're entitled to do that. As Dr. Cullen shows in the Tax Working Group report, the difficulty that's occurred in New Zealand is that the effective tax rate on those investments is very low, and that's because you can write off all forms of services and costs related to those second and third properties, so property management fees, maintenance fees, insurance, what have you, and you can also offset other income against them. So you can build up a, you know, very tidy property portfolio, and the tax that you would pay on it is effectively very low, you know, relative to the tax that you might pay if you ran a small business or something like that, or you invested on the New Zealand stock market. I don't know what the magic number is, but I say I agree with Dr. Cullen that the rate that's currently charged on, you know, substantial property investments by private citizens, residential properties in New Zealand, is too low. Somehow or another, we've got to even that up.
And on that, it kind of comes into this about how we can make different investments. Do you think that Aotearoa in general and Auckland specifically, the speculation and investment in housing rather than in entrepreneurial endeavours and innovation and in the markets has had negative effects on either just the general city or country as well as the housing market?
That's absolutely the case, Oscar. You know, New Zealand has relatively low capital formation rate for substantial businesses. We form small businesses at a cracking rate, at a good rate, but trying to get up a bigger business or medium-sized business in New Zealand is quite hard, you know, and companies that are already running find it quite difficult to raise capital. If you've got a really strong startup business and, you know, once upon a time zero under Rod Drury was such a business, it's hard to get people to back you because there are investments that look much better on paper, partly because of their tax status and partly because there's a ready market for them, that's property. So yeah, there's no doubt at all that, you know, the status of Auckland as a city with extremely high property prices, you know, up there with Hong Kong, Sydney, New York, yeah, and with relatively low company formation, for particularly for bigger firms, it's had an enormous impact on us.
How do you think we can encourage people to move their speculation and investment? Would that be by, say, raising the tax rate on and multiple home investments, as you mentioned before?
The capital gains tax that Dr. Cullen proposes would probably have some impact on that, although it's unclear to what degree. And some other members of the working group, particularly Robin Oliver, say that it wouldn't have much of an impact. Tax is one thing. You know, there's other things like your ability to get skilled labour, your ability to get IP rights and breakthrough technology. A big issue for New Zealand firms is getting access to other markets, because as a domestic market we're quite small. So, you know, getting into the US, Australia, Europe is a very big issue for firms like Xero and you know, breakout tech firms. So that's a bigger issue, and you know, one that's perplexed a couple of governments in New Zealand. Tax in its own right isn't enough to try and break the dam.
You suggest a suspension of the Resource Management Act of 1991 mm-hmm. to further the development of Auckland. What are the benefits of this, and are there any dangers of deregulating development?
So in the book I suggest, and I want to acknowledge Graham Scott, who's a very notable Auckland architect, who put this idea into my head. The difference between Auckland and the rest of New Zealand is very notable when you come to the issues about planning and resource allocation in Auckland. So the issues in Auckland are how you can build and how quickly, how much it costs, and the impact on the natural environment. Those are the three really perplexing issues if you want to build houses, roads, whatever it is. And they're in some instances very different, and other instances slightly different to the rest of New Zealand. The Resource Management Act, though, you know, regulates everything from a multi-storey building in Milford through to a dairy farm proposed in Southland. My argument is that Auckland needs an Urban Development Act that allows you to build pretty swiftly at as low a cost as possible and with the minimum impact on the natural environment. It's not designed, and it wouldn't be designed, to be a developer's dream. There's one thing that you can be sure of, which is New Zealand, or Auckland particularly, doesn't want to become the Gold Coast, where development was allowed to rip away and possibly one of the best beaches in Australia is now in the shadow of, you know, 25-storey buildings. So if you design an act for Auckland, you want to preserve the natural environment, you want to preserve some appeal rights for neighbours, and you want to keep costs down. My argument in the book is that Auckland is one of the few places in New Zealand where that's the biggest single issue. And hence, you know, I suggest suspending the RMA, giving Auckland its own development and consenting act, and giving Auckland Council more autonomy, greater power over how it administers that.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.